This presentation is about the book Created Lies. It was published in May 2016. Its subtitle is The Auschwitz Museum's Misrepresentations, Distortions, and Deceptions. The main part of the book was written by Italian Holocaust historian Carlo Mattonio. Its preface is written by Gemma Rudolph, and it has a smaller contribution by the American documentary filmmaker Eric Hunt. It is volume 38 of the series Holocaust Handbooks, and was published by Castlet Publishers, a division of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. I've divided this presentation into two sections. The first part deals with how the Auschwitz Museum dupes millions of visitors. Some 1.5 million tourists visit the Auschwitz camp every year. All of them visit the so-called main camp that hosts most of the museum's exhibits. The most important asset of that museum is the old crematorium, which you can see in the picture on the right. It is claimed that the morgue of this crematorium was misused as a homicidal gas chamber in the years 1941 and 1942. In this first part of my documentation, I will show how the Auschwitz Museum has lied for decades about post-war alterations made right after the war by the museum. And even now that they've changed the story a little bit, they keep on lying to the public about these alterations. The second part of my presentation is about how the Auschwitz Museum lies about the documents in its archives. After many decades of analyzing original German wartime documents, which were disclosed by the Soviets in the early 1990s, the Auschwitz Museum has finally published an eager study which claims to document the beginnings of the extermination of the Jews in that camp. You can see the cover of that book on the right side. We will shed light in my second part of this presentation on how the Auschwitz researchers distort and misrepresent the contents and meaning of that documentary material in their attempt to prove that their orthodox narrative is correct. The Auschwitz Museum's misrepresentations regarding its main asset, the alleged homicidal gas chamber and the old crematorium, were first brought to the attention of a broader public by the American Jew David Cole, who made a documentary about that in 1992. This documentary can be found on the internet. I've given here three addresses for it. However, since it is of a very low quality, I refrain from showing it here since it can't really be reproduced properly. I'm just going to show a few screenshots of it and will explain the main points David Cole made in his documentary. Some 16 minutes into the documentary, David Cole goes to the old crematory and in particular there into the gas chamber to point out a number of features that are inconsistent with the official story as it is told to tourists at the museum by the tour guides. The first thing he points out are traces on the wall and floor of former separation walls. The screenshot here shows a little bit of what he is pointing to, but I have found a better image on the internet, which I want to show here. The red arrow is pointing to the traces of one of those separation walls on the floor. Another issue that David Cole points out are toilet drains on the floor still visible today. Here too, the screenshot is too low in resolution to recognize anything, so I got an image of those drains from the internet. It's needless to say that toilets in a gas chamber are somewhat awkward. Both the toilet drains and the separation walls, which left the traces on the wall and the floor, stem from the phase when the place was used as an air raid shelter in 1944. Shortly after discussing these issues, David Cole enters into this alleged gas chamber again with his tour guide. Before going into the building, he asks his tour guide whether the building is in its original state, and she does confirm it. While inside the alleged homicidal gas chamber, he asks her whether those introduction holes in the ceiling are original as well, and she again states that they are original. Overwhelmed by the incessant questions David Cole asks her, she asks her supervisor to discuss this with him. When David Cole asks her supervisor whether those introduction holes are original, she denies it. She says instead that they were put in after the war. The supervisor of the tour guides was eventually exasperated by Cole's incessant questioning as well and asked him to actually arrange for a meeting with Dr. Pieper, the curator of the museum. And this did indeed take place, and David Cole managed to tape the interview. Again, due to the low quality of this video, I will refrain from showing it here, but I show a number of screenshots of the relevant passages of this interview. Regarding the conversion of that old crematorium to an air raid shelter, and after the war, about the quote-unquote reconstruction of that building by the museum, Dr. Pieper gave a detailed explanation. Pieper's original statements can be read from the subtitles in the screenshots. I will quote him here, but I've cleaned up the language a little bit. He said, "In 1944, in connection with the bombardment of Auschwitz by Allied air forces, the empty crematorium 1 and the gas chamber at Auschwitz 1 were adopted as an air raid shelter. At that time, additional walls were built inside the former gas chamber, as an additional entrance was made from the east side of the gas chamber, and the openings in the ceiling through which the gas Zyklon B was discharged inside were at that time liquidated. So after the liberation of the camp, the former gas chamber presented the view of an air raid shelter. In order to regain the earlier view, the earlier appearance of this object, the inside walls built in 1944 were removed and the openings in the ceiling were made anew. So now this gas chamber is very similar to this one which existed in 1941-1942. But not all details were made there, so there is no gas-tight doors, for instance. The additional entrance from the east side remained as it was made in 1944. Such changes were made here after the war in order to regain the earlier appearance of the object." When Cole asked him then whether the new holes were put in the exact same location where they had been during the war, Pieper answered, "Yes, in the same place, because the traces were visible on the ceiling." In the 1990s, David Cole's video made a huge impact because, first of all, he was a Jew, and as such, he got away with questioning parts of the Holocaust story and was taken seriously by a lot of people. And secondly, because he obviously exposed that the Auschwitz Museum was presenting their main exhibit, their most important exhibit, that is to say, the alleged gas chamber in the old crematorium, in a very dishonest way to the millions of visitors coming to that museum. They knew perfectly well that it had been modified after the war, but the tour guides who would tell people about the place were obviously telling lies to the visitors, and there was no plaque, no description, no explanation anywhere to be found at that time that would explain to the tourists that what they are seeing is not the original state and is not a proper reconstruction of what it was like before the air raid shelter phase. These issues being revealed by that video were powerful arguments to show that the Auschwitz Museum was lying to the public. The repercussions of the Cole video were quite big. I have listed here 3 points. The first is that because of this video and the prominence that David Cole got subsequently, he managed to appear on national TV in the US, first at 60 Minutes in 1992, and then roughly 2 years later on the Phil Donahoe show, of which there is a screenshot on the right-hand side. You can watch both of these documentaries featuring David Cole and other individuals at the links given below. The more long-term effect of David Cole's video was that mainstream media started discussing the dishonesty of the Auschwitz Museum. For instance, one of the most important media publications on that issue was in France in 1995 by a certain Eric Conan, a staunch anti-revisionist and a Jew, I think, too, who wrote in an article that pretty much everything there at that old crematorium is wrong, is misrepresented. And he even referred in this regard to the Cole video, saying that these falsehoods are being exploited by revisionists. A year later, a book appeared by Dutch cultural historian Robert van Pelt and the American historian Deborah Dork on the history of Auschwitz as a city, where they also talk about the Auschwitz concentration camp. And in this context, also about the alleged reconstruction of Crematorium 1. And they say there that the problem for the Auschwitz Museum was that the claimed extermination of the Jews mainly took place in a completely different part of the camp, that is to say the Birkenau camp, which is almost completely obliterated. There's not much to see, and therefore it's not well suited as a tourist attraction, whereas the old main camp is pretty much completely intact. And so the museum decided to create a place as a demonstration of how it looked like in Birkenau. Van Pelt actually wrote here, crematorium was reconstructed to speak for the history of what has actually happened in Birkenau. So this was a program of usurpation, and it was rather detailed. But he says there are no signs to explain these reconstructions, and there's nothing marked, and the guides even remain silent about the fact that modifications have been made, as we have seen in the cold video. The long-term effect of the cold video was then that the Auschwitz Museum started owning up to their mistakes, to their dishonesty of the past, and started putting up signs to explain the situation and instructing their guides properly about what the truth is, or what they claim the truth is. Now, going back to the original story, what I show here is a composite picture of the situation as it was until the early 2000s. Number one is the so-called victim's entry, as it was claimed until maybe 10 years ago. So this is actually air raid shelter entry that was added to the building only in 1944 and was not present when the place is said to have been used as a homicidal gas chamber. So that was the dishonesty one. And number two actually shows a sign for the tourists that were coming into that place back then, actually claiming that this is the victim's entry. Number three shows the gallows that were erected in front of the crematorium after the war, and where the former Auschwitz camp commandant Rudolf Höss was executed after he had been tried. Let's now turn to the situation as it is today. The big picture on the left shows a sign that was put up by the Auschwitz Museum right in front of the old crematorium. It shows two ground plans. On the left, it depicts the situation as it was in 1942, and on the right, it shows the situation as it is today. This situation is pretty much the same as it was right after the museum had, quote-unquote, reconstructed the building after the war. To the right of that sign is another sign of the same size, which has an explanation. I will later on quote a few phrases from that explanation. There should actually be a third ground plan showing the situation as it was in 1944, when the building served as an air raid shelter. And the reason for that is that some of the features in the room shown today as a gas chamber can only be understood if one knows that it once was an air raid shelter. David Corliss pointed out in his documentary the leftovers of the separation walls and of drains from a toilet. These were, of course, not features of the gas chamber / morgue, but of the actual air raid shelter. Of particular interest to us is here the room marked with a C, which I have surrounded with a blue square, which is the alleged gas chamber or morgue. Original German wartime documents actually only speak of a morgue and never of a gas chamber. But be that as it may, now let's focus on the right-hand ground plan, the situation as it is today. I want to point out there are three features. The first one, see the red arrow from the top, points at the entrance that was added when the building was converted into an air raid shelter in 1944. As Dr. Pieper pointed out, this entrance should have been removed but wasn't removed when the building was quote-unquote reconstructed after the war. The second feature is a dotted line which actually indicates a wall that was there but has been removed. If we compare the right-hand plan with the left-hand one of 1942, we see that in the plan of 1942, the rooms C and B are separated by the wall, whereas in a planned joint situation as it is today, does not have that wall. Now, when the building served as an air raid shelter, there were many more separation walls, and when the museum quote-unquote reconstructed the building after the war, they removed those walls and removed one more than they should have. So the actual room as it is presented today is longer than the original gas chamber slash morgue. The third thing is the opening that connects the furnace room with the claimed gas chamber slash morgue. If we compare the situation as it is today with the way it was in 1942, we see that these openings are not in the same spot. When the building was converted into an air raid shelter, that opening connecting the morgue with the furnace room was walled up. After the war, the museum reopened it, unfortunately not in the proper spot. The picture to the right shows the entrance that was added in 1944, when the building was converted to an air raid shelter. That particular photo was taken in 2012 and shows that that entranceway has been chained off by the museum and a sign put up saying no entrance. So ever since, the museum has adopted the new policy of trying to explain the situation to the visitors. They are also no longer claiming that this is the victim's entry. Let's now focus on the Zyklon B introduction holes. The two ground plans and the captions don't mention those Zyklon B holes at all. There are, however, two short phrases in the explanation on the other sign that is not depicted here, which address the issue. The first one concerns what the museum claims happened to those holes when the building was converted into an air raid shelter in 1944. I quote, "The holes in the roof through which the SS had poured Zyklon B were sealed." The second phrase on the museum sign dealing with the Zyklon B shafts addresses the issue of the post-war reconstructions, and I quote, "After the war, the museum partially reconstructed the gas chamber and crematorium. The chimney and two incinerators were rebuilt using original components, as were several of the openings in the gas chamber roof." Now, they don't say actually here that the insertion shafts were put exactly where they claim to have been during the war, but that is probably tacitly assumed. The big picture on the left shows the roof of the crematorium, and the four red arrows I've added point at the four Zyklon B insertion shafts as they were included in that roof after the war by the museum authorities. The smart picture on the top right shows an inside view of one of those shafts, as the tourists can see it when they visit the alleged gas chamber slash morgue. The question now is, how do they know that the Zyklon B insertion shafts, as we see them today, are exactly in the same spot as they were during the war? We've heard Dr. Pieper in the interview say they know it because when the reconstructions were done, they could still see the old traces of the holes on the ceiling. Now, he cannot possibly know that from personal experience because he was born in 1941, and when the reconstructions were done, he was only a little child. So the question that needs to be asked is there any documentation about that? And that is exactly what we have done. We have asked the museum whether there is any document or photograph that shows how the interior of that crematorium looked like before any alterations were done, right after the war, when Soviet and Polish authorities took over the place. Furthermore, the question is there any documentation as to what happened, what changes were made? Are there plans, blueprints, protocols of the changes, cost estimates, work orders, materials used, and so forth? And This is actually the answer we did receive from the Auschwitz Museum from Dr. Igor Bartosik, who is a co-author of the book we will later review. He said in response to these questions, and I quote from his letter, "In response to your letter from 14th of March, I would like to inform you that unfortunately we cannot help you. Our museum does not have any documents on the matters that interest you. From the memories of former employees, very often ex-prisoners, we know that the work on the construction of furnaces, chimney, etc., were made in the second half of 1947. So now we know that we don't know for sure, because there are no documents about how the place looked like at the time of liberation, and there are no documents of what happened during the reconstruction. We only apparently have memories. Asked whether he could make available copies of those witness statements, Dr. Bartosik actually sent only one. I've reproduced here the second page of that witness statement. It was made by Adam Swodnitsky in November of 1981. Swodnitsky had been an inmate at Auschwitz and afterwards stayed there and was temporarily employed as a guard. Now, this is of course not a statement that comes from a person directly involved in those reconstructions, because that would have been either employees of the museum authorities in charge of planning and implementing that reconstruction, or the companies or employees of the companies that did those reconstructions. So we are looking here at the testimony of a bystander who can hardly have had a lot of first-hand knowledge of what was going on during that reconstruction, particularly inside the building. His section dealing with the Zyklon B introduction shafts is of interest here in particular. Quote, I remember exactly that the introduction holes for Zyklon B gas, which used to be in the roof of the crematorium, were also reconstructed. The task of those charged with this reconstruction was facilitated by the fact that distinct traces of the cement patches of the earlier openings were left in the spots of the old introduction holes. Hence, new openings were broken through at the same spots, and little chimneys were built with bricks. This work was also done in the years 1946-1947, unquote. The problem with this statement, apart from the fact that it is by an uninvolved bystander, is the claim that those introduction chimneys were built with bricks. As a matter of fact, the actual introduction shafts have been made with wooden boards, and as we've seen on the picture before, still are made of wooden boards. You can see from this that this is indeed the statement of a person who did not exactly know what had been going on. Now, the implication of all this is rather severe, because the old crematorium at the Auschwitz main camp is supposed to have been a murder weapon of gigantic proportions. That means that the situation as it presented itself right after the war was the evidence for a crime committed by means of throwing Zyklon B through holes in the ceiling. That is the claim. So the traces that were allegedly left in the ceiling when the SS patched up those holes while converting it to an air raid shelter would have been prime evidence to show that these Zyklon B insertion shafts actually existed. However, instead of documenting these traces, instead of securing the evidence, what the Auschwitz Museum authorities did was to tamper with that evidence, to remove the evidence, these traces, by knocking through new holes and building new insertion shafts. So what they have done there is basically destroy the evidence that could have been used and could be used to this day to prove what the SS said to have committed there. Now, I've put up here a screenshot of a webpage from Wikipedia. The topic is spoliation of evidence. If you tamper with evidence, then you're actually yourself committing a crime. And I quote, the spoliation of evidence is the intentional, reckless, or negligent withholding, hiding, altering, fabricating, or destroying of evidence relevant to a legal proceeding. And there had actually been going on a number of legal proceedings in Poland right after the war against the commandant of the Auschwitz camp, Höss, and later against the whole staff of the Auschwitz camp, as the Polish authorities could get their hands on. So actually tampering with evidence, as the Auschwitz Museum did when they quote-unquote reconstructed the crematorium is criminal by statute in many countries, and many other countries criminal by case law. Now, the indirect implications of that are, and I quote again Wikipedia down below, the theory of the spoliation inference is that when a party destroys evidence, it may be reasonable to infer that the party had consciousness of guilt or other motivation to avoid the evidence. Therefore, the fact finder may conclude that the evidence would have been unfavorable to the spoliator. In other words, if you don't secure the evidence but rather tamper with it and destroy it, it can safely be assumed that the evidence did not support what you are claiming. In that case, the evidence does not support the claim that there were four introduction holes in the roof during the wartime and that the shafts we see today were put into a place that showed traces of former holes. This is, of course, only an indirect inference. Now let's look at the situation as it presents itself today and compare it with what we had before. I've already mentioned the maps put up by the Auschwitz Museum in front of the old crematorium do not show any traces of those insertion holes and where they were located. Now we rectify the situation by drawing our own maps where we actually put them in. The first one here shows the morgue as it was in 1942. The alleged homicidal gas chamber. It is the lengthy room here to the right. Drawn in is the ceiling in dark gray and the four holes as they present themselves today. You can already see here that the distribution of those four holes in the ceiling is rather awkward. Our next slide shows the situation as it was in 1944 while the building was used as an air raid shelter. The red arrows point to the additional separation walls put in at that time, and the blue arrow at the vestibule that leads to the entrance added to the air raid shelter. Again, the distribution of those holes for that particular situation doesn't make sense either. The next slide shows the situation as it has been after the building had been quote-unquote reconstructed. The blue arrow pointing at the entrance that was left in place, and the four arrows at the walls that have been removed, including the one that was removed too many. I blend over repeatedly here the situation as it was in 1942 to show the difference. My next slide reveals what the real origins of these introduction shafts are that we have today. I have included here some distances of the holes to the next wall along the long side of the room. And from this we can see that they were put in to be at equidistances from opposite walls as the situation is today with one wall removed too much. Again, I blend over the situation as it was in 1942 where the distribution is completely out of whack. From this we can safely infer that these holes were put in under consideration of the measurements of that room as they are today and not as they were during the war. The question we now should ask is whether it is conceivable that the Auschwitz Museum committed a forgery back in 1946-47 when they did their quote-unquote reconstruction by putting Zyklon B holes into the roof where there had been none before. The answer to that is yes, it is conceivable because we have a precedent. This concerns the Majdanek camp, where we have three rooms actually that have similar holes in the ceiling, and for many decades it has been claimed that these rooms served as execution chambers using Zyklon B. The first one pictured here is a room which officially had been a morgue and is located in the so-called new crematorium of the camp. You can see here the hole in the ceiling surrounded by a yellow circle. It is located directly over a drain in the floor. You see the circle at the bottom. If you throw Zyklon B through there, it would fall right into the drain, which is not a good design. More importantly, however, this room has an opening in the wall that cannot be closed, and it actually never had a ventilation system. So it is absolutely inconceivable to use poison gas in that room because you would set the whole building under gas and you would then not be able to get rid of it properly. The hole in that ceiling can be seen in the inset here, a close-up, where you can see that it has been crudely hacked through the concrete and not even the reinforcement bars in that reinforced concrete ceiling have been removed. This picture shows another hole in the ceiling of yet another room. And for this as well, for many decades it has been claimed that it was used to throw in Zyklon B. The very crude craftsmanship can be seen here too, with the reinforcement bar still in it. The next picture, again, another room with the same background. Interestingly, the impossibility of performing gassings in those rooms for a number of reasons has been demonstrated by a revisionist book that first appeared in the German language in 1998 and then later in English too, and is currently available in its third edition. 7 years after the publication of that revisionist study, the Polish Majdanek Museum published an article by its director, Tomasz Krantz, who discarded most of the claims about homicidal gassings, including all of those about Zyklon B allegedly thrown through those openings. Even though he did not openly come out saying that these holes are a hoax committed by the Soviets and Poles right after the war, the conclusion is inevitable that this is actually the case. In other words, the Soviets and the Poles created these holes after the war to propagate the hoax that in these rooms, people were mass murdered with Zyklon B, which is today admitted to be untrue. So yes, the Polish and Soviet authorities after the war were perfectly capable and willing to commit such forgeries. All this is, of course, still only circumstantial evidence, even though I think it would be enough for an independent court to sentence the Auschwitz Museum authorities for having committed a forgery. Let us now turn to a different piece of evidence which clarifies what that room claimed to have been a homicidal gas chamber actually was. I have here a blueprint of the crematorium that was drawn in November 1940. This is before the time when it is claimed to have been used as a homicidal gas chamber. Of interest there is the area that I surrounded with a red rectangle. This is a swinging door. Down at the bottom we have the morgue. It says in German Leichenraum, which is corpse room. And at the top we have the Ofenraum, the furnace room. So what we have here, and I enlarge it to make it better visible, is a door that could easily be pushed to either side, which makes sense if you are dragging heavy corpses. You don't have your hands free to operate door handles. Now, if you think that they actually changed the door design to a heavy steel door that is both gas tight and secured against panicking people, you're up for a rude awakening. Here is shown the SS blueprint of that crematorium from April 1942, right in the middle of when it is said to have been used as a homicidal gas chamber. And as we can see again inside the red square, there it still is, the swinging door. I enlarge it again to make it more visible. Dr. Pieper's claim that there have been gas-tight doors in that gas chamber which were not put back in when they did their quote-unquote reconstruction is not true. The plans actually show it has never been changed to anything else than a swinging door serving to connect a morgue with the cremation furnace hall. As a matter of fact, there is a later blueprint even from when it was about to be converted into an air raid shelter. And there, too, the swinging door can be seen, even though that is obviously a mistake because that door was obviously later on walled up. Yet still, it shows that this swinging door has never been changed, and it should be obvious that such a swinging door can neither be secured against a panicking crowd, nor can it ever be made gas-tight. This pretty much seals the case of claims that that room has ever been a homicidal gas chamber. I finished the first part of my presentation, therefore, with a conclusion that what the Auschwitz Museum is showing to millions of tourists at Auschwitz in Crematorium 1 is not a reconstruction of an alleged homicidal gas chamber, but is actually a forgery committed in the attempt to prove false claims about this room having been used as a homicidal gas chamber. We now get to the second part of this presentation, the documents. The majority of all the archival material about the Auschwitz camp has actually survived the war. And most importantly, the files of the Central Construction Office are almost completely intact. Those files were confiscated by the Soviets at war's end and taken to Moscow, where they were hidden and inaccessible to Western researchers until around the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. Italian historian Carlo Mottoni was granted access to those archives in the mid-1990s, resulting in a plethora of publications on Auschwitz in subsequent years. The Auschwitz Museum obtained a complete microfilm copy of that material around the same time, but they have published only very little about Auschwitz ever since. The most recent publication by the Auschwitz Museum was published in 2014, and has as its author the already quoted Dr. Igor Bartosik and also the head of the Auschwitz Museum, Dr. Piotr Setkiewicz, who is depicted here at the right in an interview that he gave recently, and it can be found on YouTube at the address given. This is pretty much the essence of 20 years of investigating the archival material that the Auschwitz Museum received from Moscow. As we see in the table of contents, this bilingual book has, first of all, an introduction, which is 16 pages long, and then has several sections containing reproductions of 74 documents, each of which comes with a brief caption and interpretation of the three Auschwitz scholars. I show here the first two documents, how they are rendered, and the captions and comments added to them by the authors. This shows that this book has very little text. As a matter of fact, the net total amounts to only some 35 pages of text. Let's start with the first sentence of the book. We read there, I quote, "For many years, the beginning of the extermination of Jews in the gas chambers has been one of the least researched issues in the extensive literature on the history of Kyle Auschwitz. Numerous monumental works by historians devote only a few pages to the question." In the footnote, then, we find three books. The first one is actually one by the Auschwitz Museum itself. It is their so-called magnum opus on the Auschwitz camp in general. It contains only a brief section on one aspect of the beginning of the claimed extermination. Even though the five-volume work is rather voluminous, it does make very little use of the vast documentation found in Moscow. The other two works are even less interesting in this regard. The second, by Jean-Claude Pressac, was actually published before the material in Moscow became accessible. And the last, by Robert van Pelt, is very superficial in many regards because he's not an expert on the topics and most certainly not an expert on any archival material in this regard, since he never had any real access to it. What is more important, however, is the fact that the first two sentences of this book already contain a major lie. The fact is that no less than three entire monographs have been published on the issue of the early history of homicidal gassings at Auschwitz. They were written by the Italian Holocaust historian Carlo Mottoni, and they do not follow the orthodox party line, and this is probably why the authors at the Auschwitz Museum simply ignore those books. However, since these are the only books that have ever been published about the topic, it is impossible for a scholar to actually ignore them unless he wants to be called unscholarly. Each of these three books is dedicated to a certain aspects of the early history. The first one focuses on the claimed very first gassing at Auschwitz. The second book is focused on Crematorium 1, the old crematorium and the main camp, which we had covered in the first section of this presentation. And the last one is about the so-called bunkers of Auschwitz, which we will encounter in this part of the presentation a number of times. All of these books taken together have some 450 pages of text and more than 100 documents and photographs. Since they have all been published at least 9 years, some of them even more than 10 years prior to the Auschwitz Museum's book, it is absolutely untenable to claim that about that issue no major research has been published. As a matter of fact, the books by Carlo Martagno have more than 10 times the text that this new book by the Auschwitz Museum has. Turning to the second page, we find two more lies. I quote the first sentence. As a result of extensive researches conducted in both the Zentralbauleitung collection and the other archival resources, a range of interesting and previously unknown documents has been identified. Now, this is a rather disingenuous claim because of those 74 documents published in this book, 9 have already been published before by Carlo Martagno. 19 more had been mentioned in footnotes and discussed by Carlo Martagno, and 3 had been published by the French Auschwitz researcher Jean-Claude Pessac. If we exclude the 9 documents the authors published in their booklet about the Auschwitz railway ramp, which were absolutely irrelevant when it comes to trying to prove genocide or mass murder, then 31 of the 65 documents are not new at all. If we scroll a little bit further down on that page, we run into the next lie. I quote, "These documents make it possible significantly to clarify the chronology of events and to confirm facts known until now only through witness accounts. It should nevertheless be noted that the documents do not usually refer directly to killings in the gas chamber, and interpreting the entries sometimes requires a detailed familiarity not only with other documents, but also with the reality of the camp." The lie is contained here in what I underscore here in bold. That says, do not usually refer directly to killings. It is actually a hypocritical understatement because none of the documents, either the ones published in the book under discussion or anywhere else or in the archives, ever refer directly or indirectly to killings in homicidal gas chambers or any other sinister activities. And in addition to that, the documents actually contradict witness statements. They don't confirm them. Plus, the familiarity with other documents refutes homicidal claims. And finally, finding homicidal intent in them requires either unfamiliarity with the documents or mendacity about their contents and context. Now, these are, of course, bold claims, and the burden of proof is on my side, so I will spend the rest of this documentation in proving step by step, document by document, that my claims are true. First, we have the pervasive lie. That is the claim that there was one and only one kind of Sonderkommando, that is, special unit at Auschwitz. The Orthodox historians claim that this Sonderkommando was a unit of inmates, almost all of them Jews. They are said to have been in charge of dragging corpses out of the gas chambers. And I show here a drawing by the Auschwitz inmate, David Oleyer, who has drawn a few sketches about what he claims to have witnessed. That was actually drawn in a year after the war. Furthermore, there's Sonderkommandos were in charge of extracting gold teeth, of cutting off long hair for recycling, and cremating corpses in furnaces or on pyres. And I have another picture here, again by David Oleyer, that shows the process of cremating those victims in cremation ovens. Again, this is claimed to have been the only type of Sonderkommando. So Orthodox historians, when they encounter the term Sonderkommando in a document, they automatically connect this to homicidal activity. And here is what they know but are hiding from you. Already in 2000, Carlo Martagna, the Italian Holocaust historian, published a monograph that proves their thesis wrong. The book is called Special Treatment in Auschwitz, Origin and Meaning of a Term. The first English edition is from 2004, but the original Italian edition actually appeared already in 2000. The book explains the context and meaning of a lot of documents containing terms like special treatment, special operation, special measure, and special unit as they appear in documents pertaining to Auschwitz. Here are the pages 102 and 103 of Martagna's book, where he lists Sonderkommandos that he found in various documents which have absolutely nothing to do with any homicidal activities. Here are the actual German terms with the meaning in English. First, we have a pest control unit made up of women. Then we have a very important one, which we'll encounter later, a very large special unit consisting of women who were assigned to sorting clothes that inmates brought into the camp when they were deported. Then we have several units working in various sections of the camp or even in sub-camps outside of the actual camp. Then we have at the end of the list the Sonderkommando Zeppelin, which I will address on the next slide. Now, the Sonderkommando Zeppelin I just mentioned was actually not even a proper part of the Auschwitz camp. It is only mentioned on occasion in documents pertaining to Auschwitz, because it wasn't too far away from that camp. Thomas Kues has made a review of literature and documents for the term Sonderkommando in connection with SS in general, and published a paper on it. And I've listed here the SS Sonderkommandos he has found in literature and documents, none of which, except for the first one, have anything to do with Auschwitz. From all this, we can see that Auschwitz has been buzzing with Sonderkommandos all over the place in charge of all kinds of activities. And not just Auschwitz, but the whole SS organization in the whole German territory and beyond was littered with Sonderkommandos. While he was compiling the documents for the critical review of the Auschwitz Museum's latest book, Carlo Martagna actually found two more Sonderkommandos. The first one is a Sonderkommando of the dental station that was in charge of removing alloy fillings and dentures from corpses. So the legend has it that the Sonderkommando was in charge of removing teeth, and apparently there is some truth to it. There was actually a dedicated Sonderkommando at the dental station at Auschwitz that was in charge of doing this to people who had died for whatever cause. Now, there's no doubt that 100,000 people or even more died in Auschwitz due mainly to the terrible diseases that raged in the camp. And it is normal practice to remove metal fillings and dentures from corpses before they're being cremated, because metal fillings would actually mess up your cremation muffler if you leave them in the corpse. Now, the second Sonderkommando he found on top of what he had listed in his earlier book was a Sonderkommando working at the railway ramp when prisoners arrived to remove, clean, disinfest, and store inmate property. Carlo Martagna found references to the Sonderkommando mainly in witness statements that were made during the big Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial in the mid-1960s. Two of the witnesses that Carlo Martagna quotes are defendants, whereas four are actually survivors that have testified for the prosecution. And their statements caused some confusion with the judges, who always thought that Sonderkommando was, according to the legend, the inmate commando in charge of dealing with the murdered prisoners in the gas chambers. This Sonderkommando is actually connected to an activity that was gigantic in proportion. I have here two pictures that give a little bit of an impression about the problems the camp was facing due to the massive amounts of property that the inmates brought into the camp. The first one shows how inmates dumped clothes that prisoners brought into the camp from a truck onto the ground and sorting it. And the second picture, shows an inside view of one of the huts that had been erected in order to store inmate property. Now, as you can see, that stuff wasn't treated properly. It looks like they've just dumped it there. There are many similar pictures on the internet. The Orthodox narrative has it that some, if not most, of the Sonderkommandos actually worked in the crematoria of Birkenau, where they were in charge, as it is claimed, as I've already mentioned, in dragging out the corpses from the gas chambers. Now, there is a plethora of documents concerning the crematoria, both when they were built and operated, and also including the staff that was operating them, most of them inmates. However, none of these documents ever mention the term Sonderkommando in that context. Documents dealing with the staff actually call them simply staff of crematorium, so-and-so, or they have some bureaucratic number assigned. There's only one document that has been found so far where the Sonderkommando is brought in the context of a crematorium, and I display it here. Underline in red the term Sonderkommando crematorium. This is actually a document that relates to an escape of members of that Sonderkommando. And it was written by a member of the guards or a member of the local Gestapo, the German secret political police, who were in charge of chasing down escapees and getting them either back into a camp or shooting them. So this is not a document by the camp administration or by any authority that was in charge of running the crematoria or employing and supervising those inmate units that were operating it or working in it. So we cannot expect them to be aware of the proper terminology to use. Since Auschwitz and the area was buzzing with Sonderkommandos, it cannot surprise us that they use that in the context. However, it does not prove that actually there exists anything like a Sonderkommando bearing that name working in any of the crematoria. Translating that document, it reads, around 2 p.m. today, a large number of prisoners escaped from the concentration camp Auschwitz II from the Sonderkommando, in parentheses, crematorium, mostly Jews. Some of the fugitives have already been shot during the instantly initiated pursuit. The search operation continues. Fact is, to summarize the topic of Sonderkommando, that there were many such units bearing that name in Auschwitz, none of which had anything to do with homicidal activities, and none of the units working in the crematoria officially bore that name. This proves that the Auschwitz Museum's claim that anywhere the term Sonderkommando appears, a connection has to be made to homicidal activities, actually turns the truth upside down. Before we delve any deeper into the documents, I have to explain a term here. And that is the bunkers or bunkers of Auschwitz. The early history of the extermination of Jews at Auschwitz is said to have happened in three stages. The first one is the alleged first homicidal gassing, a topic that is not covered at all in the book that we are reviewing here, published by the Auschwitz Museum. The second stage is the gas chamber supposedly operated inside the old crematorium at the main camp, and we have covered that in the first section of this presentation. Now, the third and last stage of this early history is said to have happened in the bunkers. Now, here is what Orthodox historiography claims about that. In the first half of 1942, two old farmhouses near the Birkenau camp were converted into makeshift homicidal gas chambers. Today they are usually referred to as Bunker 1 and Bunker 2, though that term was not used by early eyewitnesses. I show here a picture drawn by David O'Leary again. We have encountered him before. He is showing what he considers to be one of those bunkers, actually Bunker 2 in that case, and how inmates are digging out a mass grave. That's the second point I have here. At these bunkers, units of Jewish inmates called Sonderkommando 1 and 2 had to drag out the corpses of the murdered and either bury them in mass graves or later burn them on pyres. Now, the eyewitness statements in this regard are rather contradictory. I have here to illustrate that another drawing by another survivor, that's Dov Pazikovic. If you compare this drawing with the one that David O'Leary made, there's hardly any resemblance. As I've mentioned before on slide 23, Italian Holocaust historian Carlo Mattonio has written an entire monograph on those bunkers of some 260 pages. He shows in there that the witness statements are highly contradictory and are at times technically absurd or even impossible. Furthermore, no document exists proving these structures, if they existed at all, were ever used for anything. And last but not least, air photos ultimately debunk claims about the open air incineration inferno claimed for the summer of 1944. These air photos were taken by Allied and German airplanes during the war and have been made accessible step by step over the last decades. There is an entire monograph on that topic written by John Clive Ball. It is called Air Photo Evidence, the cover I have shown here, and it deals with irrefutable evidence from World War II aerial photographs taken by Allied and German reconnaissance aircraft. One section in there is dealing extensively with those bunkers. Let's now discuss some omissions and misrepresentations perpetrated by the Auschwitz Museum scholars. Since the Auschwitz camp and region was buzzing with Sonderkommandos, it can't surprise that there are many documents referring to Sonderkommandos, Sonderaction, Sondermeasure, and so on. However, Zetkiewicz and his colleagues claim that all these documents refer to extermination activities, in that case, at the elusive bunkers. Some of these documents either state clearly, however, or their context at least makes it clear, that these Sonderkommandos were in charge of sorting, disinfecting, and warehousing inmate property. I've mentioned these Sonderkommandos already on slide 29. For instance, the document number 12, published in the Auschwitz Museum's book, is a request to increase the number of inmates working at the Sonderkommando. It lists as requesting department the administration of inmate property. This was exactly the Auschwitz camp's authority that supervised the Sonderkommando, which cleaned, sorted, disinfested, and stored inmate property. But Zetkiewicz and his colleague pass over this fact in silence and claim that the Sonderkommando was working at the bunkers dealing with murdered inmates. Similar document 55 in their book. It is actually a request for two guards for a Sonderkommando. It too lists as the requesting department the administration of inmate property, and that too, again, is ignored by Zetkiewicz and his colleagues. Document number 25 in their book is a list of existing barracks. It lists three barracks for personal effects for special treatment, and it is actually located at the Auschwitz main camp. The bunkers, however, are supposed to have been at the Birkenau camp, which was some 2 miles away from the main camp. Zetkiewicz and his colleague misrepresent that document and state that these were three barracks for undressing at Bunker 1 at Birkenau, clearly contradicting the document's contents. My last example here is their document number 31. It lists a building used for the storage of personal effects, including three horse stable barracks, each at Sonderkommando 1 and 2. Yet for Zetkiewicz and his colleagues, these were undressing huts at the bunkers 1 and 2. Let's talk about mistranslations next. Anyone who wants to do serious research on the Holocaust needs to be in basically perfect command of the German language, because many, if not most, of the documents pertaining to that event are in the German language. The next four examples I present here indicate that the Polish scholars at the Auschwitz Museum, who wrote the book we are criticizing here, don't have a sufficient command of the German language, which would actually disqualify them as serious Holocaust historians. My first example is their document number 11. It contains a buzzword, 19 Brennstellen. They translate that literally as 19 burning sites. Some terms, however, should never be translated literally, because then they often make no sense, and that's the case here. They mistranslate it because they translate it literally, and then they conclude, I quote, "The document refers to the beginning of the burning of corpses retrieved from the mass graves of gas chamber victims in that case," unquote. There are two problems with that. First problem is that not even the most extreme witness account has claimed anywhere near 19 open-air cremation sites at Auschwitz. And the second and more important problem is the fact that this is about electrical work performed by the inmate electrician detail, and this fact, which is clearly visible from the document, should have alerted Setkiewicz and his colleagues that Rennstein is a German technical term referring in general to a point for connecting lighting fixtures and other electrical loads. It's not a burning site. The second mistranslation happens when they deal with their document number 35. It contains the phrase bei den Ausweichbunkern, which they translate as at the reserve bunker. And then they write, this is a request for permission to erect three stable type barracks at bunker 2, referred to here as a reserve bunker. Now there are three problems with this one. First, the German wording is bei den Ausweichbunkern, which is plural. It's not at a bunker, but at many bunkers. Nobody has ever claimed that there were several gassing bunkers at any one site. The second problem is that bunker is a German term which can mean either a storage facility for bulk items like coal, potatoes, grain, etc., or an air raid shelter, or in the vernacular, it sometimes refers to a prison. The third problem is that Ausweichen does not mean reserve, but to get out of the way of something, to evade. This clearly refers to the many air raid shelters that were built around the camp's perimeter, primarily designed to be used by SS guards in the case of an air attack. There are many documents in the archives dealing with the construction of those air raid shelters, and the scholars at the Auschwitz Museum must certainly know that they exist. The third mistranslation concerns their document number 52, which contains the word Sackkalk, which means bag lime, in that case to be translated as bagged lime. It was delivered to the Sonderkommando at BW4 Birkenau. Setkiewicz and colleagues claim that this lime was used as a disinfectant when burying bodies in mass graves, with which they refer to the mass graves at bunkers 1 and 2. There are actually four problems with that interpretation. The first one is that Sackkalk is not a disinfectant, that would actually be Chlorkalk in German, chlorinated lime, but simply bagged lime, a technical term that refers to material used to make plaster and mortar. The second problem is that it was delivered together with 300 kilograms of cement, that is, together with the lime, to be used to make mortar. That entry is actually right before the one with the bagged lime. Problem number three is that just underneath that entry there's another one about 1,000 kilogram, a metric ton of cement that was delivered on July 15, 1942. Cement can actually only be used for construction, but there would have been no need for it at that time at the claimed bunkers because they were erected and operating. Problem number four, and the most important one, is that BW4 referred to 14 barracks for home economy which were being built at that time. So this Sonderkommando at that particular area of the camp had nothing to do whatsoever with homicidal activities. The last mistranslation I want to discuss here is about their document number 8. It contains the words Einmauern an der Tür in der Gaskammer, which translates to walling in of the door in the gas chamber. They have translated as follows, however, installation of doors at the second gas chamber. You see that door turned into doors and the turned into second, which they then turned into bunker 2. In their interpretation. Fact number one is, however, that the only type of gas chambers mentioned in the documents available in any archives about that issue are delousing gas chambers. Fact number two is that the buildings 5A and 5B at Birkenau, each containing a delousing gas chamber, were under construction at that time of the document, which is the 8th July of 1942. I have here an original German wartime blueprint of one of the two buildings. It is building BW5B. It shows both a cross-section and a ground plan. I magnify it here to show the word that I've surrounded with a red rectangle, reading Gaskammer, which is the German word for gas chamber. That is actually the Zyklon B delousing chamber. I have another picture here showing the outside wall of that delousing wing of this building. In front of it is standing Gemma Rudolph while taking samples. That image was taken in 1991. You see the blue stains at the wall that have formed as a result of the building having been exposed heavily to hydrogen cyanide gas, which is the toxic component of Zyklon B. Fact number three is that both homicidal gassing bunkers are said to have been operating at the time of that document. So they must have had their doors already. With this slide, I will present a staccato of nonsense produced by Setkiewicz and his colleagues. I call it the Auschwitz time paradox. As mentioned before, Setkiewicz and his colleagues interpret all documents containing Sonderwords as part of the claimed extermination of the Jews. This leads to a chronology full of contradictions and anachronisms, as I will show subsequently. First, I will show here a timeline spanning from early 1942 into late 1944. At the bottom, I will step-by-step display pivotal events of the alleged extermination of the Jews at Auschwitz. But before I start with this, I have to emphasize that the chronology I will be presenting here is a compromise which Orthodox historiography has agreed upon. The basis for this chronology are eyewitness statements, which are highly contradictory. The first event that is of interest in the present context is the activation of Bunker 1 and its two undressing huts, which is said to have occurred on the 20th of March 1942. The second event is the setup of Bunker 2 plus three undressing huts, which is said to have happened at the end of June. The next event is Heinrich Himmler's visit to the Auschwitz camp on July 17th and 18th, at which point he is said to have given the order to no longer bury the victims of the mass murder, but rather to exhume them and cremate them on pyres. The next pivotal event is a visit by Camp Commandant Hirsch and a few other staff members to the Chelmno camp to learn how to do open air cremations. This is said to have happened on September 16th. Next, we have the beginning of exhumations of mass graves and the start of the cremation of the murdered victims on pyres and later in pits. This allegedly started at the end of the summer, so I put in here the 23rd of September. The next event we need to keep in mind is the activation of the new crematoria built in Birkenau. There were four of them, and three of them became operational between March 13th and April 4th, 1943. At that point, because they were no longer needed, Bunker 1 and 2 were taken out of commission. Bunker 1, with its undressing, barracks, and anything around it, is said to have been completely abolished and the area leveled, whereas Bunker 2 is only said to have been taken out of commission. The building itself was not razed, but the mass graves were leveled as well. Finally, we have the reactivation of Bunker 2 around the middle of May 1944, including the erection of two new undressing huts. Now let's try to fit into that chronology some of the documents which Setkiewicz and his colleagues have adduced in their attempt to prove the reality of homicidal mass gassings in Auschwitz. First of all, there is the door, which I have shown was probably built into the delousing chamber, but which they claim was built into Bunker 2. As we see, the official timeline says that Bunker 2 went operational at the end of June, but that document claims the doors were built in several days, actually more than a week later. So that building wouldn't have been fit for operation probably even beyond that. The next event is on 17th of August. 500 inmates were assigned to a special unit, and Setkiewicz and colleagues claim that they were assigned to preparing the burning pits. However, official historiography says that the camp authorities did not start preparing for this until they knew how to do it, that is to say, until the camp commander Herz had traveled to Chamno in order to find out how to do it. Then we have on the 22nd of August the infamous mistranslation of the 19 burning sites, again in contradiction to the official chronology where burning sites, that is to say, pyres or pits, are supposed to have been prepared only after Hus's visit to Chamno. Next, we have documents spanning from the 7th to the 9th September regarding a few trucks full of firewood, which Setkiewicz and his colleague claim were used to burn corpses. This, too, cannot be, according to the official chronology, because the burning of corpses was prepared only after the commandant's visit to Chamno. Next, we have an event in 1943, 9th of July. The document says that a cable was to be rerouted to a Sonderkommando, number 2. Setkiewicz and his colleagues say that belongs to Bunker 2, even though at that time Bunker 2 had been retired and there wouldn't have been any reason to reconnect it with any wires. Next, on the 30th September of the same year, there is a document talking about remodeling buildings for Sonderkommando 1 and 2 and erecting 3 barracks. As a matter of fact, these had nothing to do with bunkers 1 and 2, as Setkiewicz claimed, but it's actually buildings in the inmate hospital which was under construction at that time. It wouldn't make any sense to talk about remodeling bunkers 1 and 2 anyway, because at that time bunker 1 no longer exist at all, and bunker 2 was retired and didn't require any remodeling. Apart, adding additional undressing barracks wouldn't have made any sense either for either of them, because they were not operational. Bunker 1 didn't exist to the point where actually in the area where it's supposed to have been, a huge wastewater treatment plant had been erected, and there could not possibly have been any activities in this regard. The next document we have is from 18th of March 1944, which talks about removing an electric wire from Bunker 1. This is probably concerning either an air raid shelter or a bulk storage facility, but the authors, of course, interpret it as a document pertaining to Bunker 1, which cannot be because Bunker 1 had been completely abolished and there was no trace of it anymore. There's a series of barracks that has been built throughout the history of that camp that were assigned to Sonderkommandos. Each one of them is interpreted by Setkiewicz as belonging to either Bunker 1 and Bunker 2. I want to highlight a few of them here. The first is in May, not exactly specified what date, but in May there were 2 undressing huts built next to Bunker 1, Setkiewicz claimed. Actually, there were only barracks in general to be erected for Sonderkommando number 1. We don't know which one it is, but it may just be one of those taking care of inmate property. It wouldn't make sense anyway to build undressing huts at that point in time, because Bunker 1 is said to have been operational and working with the undressing barracks already since March. The same is true for another set of huts assigned to Sonderkommando 2, which they again assigned to Bunker 2. It says they are missing in that document, when in fact at that point that building is said to have been operational and undressing huts are said to have been already there. Another nonsensical interpretation concerns a document of February 1944. It talks about removing 3 huts from Sonderkommando 1, which they again interpret as belonging to Bunker 1. They were actually storage huts, but Setkiewicz claimed they were undressing huts. And it doesn't make any sense to remove any huts from Bunker 1 at that point in time, because roughly a year ago, Bunker 1 had been completely abolished with everything around it, and in its place was now a sewage treatment plant. A similar nonsensical interpretation is regarding another set of huts for Sonderkommando 2. Setkiewicz says it's for Bunker 2. It says 3 huts are 90% finished. If we consider that Bunker 2 is said to have been reactivated in the middle of May in order to serve for the extermination of Hungarian Jews, it is awkward to consider that the undressing huts allegedly used for this purpose were still not ready some 3 weeks later. As a matter of fact, we look at another document that is from later, from the end of August, early September, it shows that three barracks are supposed to be erected at Sonderkommando 2. Again, Setkevich says it's Bunker 2. It doesn't make any sense because at that time the Hungarian action was over. It concerns the same huts that had still not been completed at that point. Air photos actually show that in the area where Bunker 2 is said to have been, two barracks were indeed erected there, but two, not three, and they were probably used for storing inmate property. Finally, we have a document of Christmas 1943 that asked to dismantle a field railway from Sonderkommando 1, which Setkevich again interprets as belonging to Bunker 1, which had been dismantled by that time for a three-quarter year, and the sewage treatment facility in the area would have prevented any field railway to be still there, so it cannot have had anything to do with anything going on in that area. The worst is yet to come, though, and with that I mean examples that cannot be explained in any way by ignorance or incompetence. I will list here five examples of them, and we go through them step by step. The first one is Setkevich's document number 3. It is from 19th of July of 1941. It says in there that a draft for a delousing facility with hydrogen cyanide system is being revised. Setkevich turns that into the claim that the SS disinfectors could next be assigned to operate the homicidal gas chambers. Now, there's nothing in the document where this phrase can be found that indicates that any such thing was going on. It's completely invented. In fact, it turns the truth upside down, because this document proves that the camp authorities were about to implement measures to save prisoners' lives, so it's an exonerating piece of evidence, but Setkevich and his colleagues turn it into an incriminating document by claiming that this is the preparation for mass murder. The second example is about their document number 64, which dates to the 4th of November 1942. This document is actually headlined Construction Project POW Camp, in parenthesis, Implementation of Special Treatment. This document proves that the entire construction project for the Birkenau Camp is labeled as Special Treatment. If we look at that document, which consists of several pages listing all kinds of construction projects in that camp, we find only one building in the list that has the actual designation Special Treatment repeated, and that is, I quote, delousing facility for special treatment. That's actually the famous Centralsauna, which was built in that camp in order to improve the hygienic situation. That is to say, to save prisoners' lives. Setkevich and his colleagues interpret this to mean that this document proves special treatment being implemented in that camp in terms of a genocide. There's nothing in that document that indicates that. Quite to the contrary, the fact that the entire camp with all its buildings has that label, and that only one has a particular label and that is meant to save the prisoners' lives, proves that Setkevich and his colleagues have again turned the truth upside down. The third example is their document 67, which dates to the 7th of January 1943. It says in that document that guards for wagon transports to the POW camp are urgently needed for the special measures to be carried out. And then, in parentheses, it continues, accommodating the announced transports of 10th to 31st January 1943. That document actually, if put into the context, is regarding the transportation of heating stoves in order to erect them in the inmate huts. So this document very obviously states that the mass transports of Jews expected to arrive at the camp in January 1943 were to be accommodated in that camp, and they needed building material to be transported to make the inmates' huts heatable. Sinkevich and his colleagues turn again the truth completely upside down by putting it into the context of what they consider the special operation to be about, that is to say, genocide. The fourth example is regarding document number 69, dated 15th of January 1943. It again talks about the accommodation of 47,000 Jews within a very short period of time. And I quote from the document the phrase that is important here. Accommodation of 47,000 Jews within a very short period of time. This office requests the immediate assignment of 6 dump trucks in order that the construction of the respective accommodations can be finished on schedule. So the document is very clear that all the Jews to be deported into the camp need to be accommodated and that new buildings have to be erected for them. Sinkevich and his colleague again turn the truth upside down by claiming that this might have been connected with preparations to deport and exterminate Jews from Greece. The document says the opposite. It says deport and accommodate. The last example is document 70 from the 22nd of May of 1943. It is a speech by Camp Commandant Hess. The phrase of interest here is the following, quote, "The solution of the Jewish question, which required creating the means to accommodate 60,000 prisoners at first, which increases to 100,000 within a short time." Sinkevich and his colleagues again interpret that as meaning that an operation to solve the Jewish question is currently underway there, with which they mean a program of genocide. Again, there is nothing in the document supporting that claim. Wrapping up my presentation, I conclude. First of all, none of the 74 documents that Sinkevich and colleagues have published has any relation whatsoever to the alleged extermination of the Jews. Second, in order to create a fictitious relation to that claimed extermination, the authors have systematically misrepresented and distorted documents. They have ignored the meaning and context of these documents. They have provided totally inconsistent and fanciful interpretations of these documents. And last but not least, they have shown a remarkable superficiality and historiographical ineptitude. Worst of all is their fundamental deception according to which there existed merely one kind of Sonderkommando at Auschwitz, that is to say, the homicidal one. So I change Piotr and say, no, his name is not Piotr, his name is Pinocchio Sinkevich. If you're not dizzy yet and you still want to know more about the Auschwitz Museum's misrepresentations, distortions and deceptions, feel free to get the book that I have presented here. It is available at the link given, or you can simply find it on Amazon by typing in the name Matonio Created Lies. I hope you enjoyed it, and thank you for watching.